This is Johnny Bluestar. Welcome to Threshold, a global media event. Is the universe just a random dance of atoms? Or is it a manifestation of a supremely intelligent architect? Can its purpose, or our purpose here on Earth, be adequately assessed? Can we commune with it, know its intentions, cooperate with its direction? Here, we define Threshold as a gateway state of awareness, allowing mankind to cross into a place of real cognition. Threshold allows us to approach questions of higher reality through the door of experience rather than mere belief. Welcome to Threshold, where we tear away the veil from commercial media, bringing our audience and participants into another realm of reality and enhanced communication.
Welcome back to Threshold Radio. We're back with Sarah K. Westall, host of Conscious Radio, with a special interest and emphasis on business game-changing innovators and their discoveries. Sarah, as a writer of books and films, but also as a songwriter, I'm interested in how you look at the disruption in the music, film, and publishing worlds provided by the internet. I believe that all three of these worlds, particularly in regards to business and distribution, have been irretrievably disrupted. But there's a very interesting article by Gareth Cuddy, the founder of Virsa, an ebook distributor and data company, which appeared in Digital Book World, which compares disruption in the book and music industry. The article entitled Publishing's Digital Disruption starts off by noting the disruptive events occurring in the music business, which I would like to discuss. Here's what Cuddy says. The music industry thought that disruption was over by 2011 when their sales began to recover somewhat. Despite digital units accounting for 64% of music sales, the consensus was that the market had stabilized and was back to business as usual. Then in 2011, a Swedish startup called Spotify launched in the U.S. After only 4 years in the mainstream, it now has over 15 million subscribers and 60 million active users. The Spotify business model has truly disrupted the music business, with artists now looking at non-traditional ways of generating sales other than records as their stable income. How do you look at the disruption in the music business, say from the last leg of vinyl in the music business until now, Sarah?
Well, digital has completely taken over for the majority of music. And when you look at the young kids, you know, vinyl has had a niche comeback, but for the masses, it's digital because it's easier. It's easier to get hold of. Kids are different than what we grew up with, right? They're on social media all the time, and they have applications. They have little apps. If they hear a little sound, a little clip of music, they play that clip, and then they search for where that song came from, and then they know the song, and then they grab that song or, you know, download it or whatever. It's amazing how they look and they retrieve music. It's a different paradigm for them than it is for us. You know, we bought music by the records. They're buying music, just it's so much more free flowing. And my daughter is amazing. She just loves music. So she's into all this. She has such an eclectic collection of music from all different industries, you know, all different artists of all different things. And it's amazing how she gets her music. And she'll listen to just some clip on a television show, record it, and then find it. And we never had that capability before. And so we've never had a time. I mean, I gotta like to look at the positives of this disruption as well. And we've never had a time in history where an average musician can really make a difference and get out there. Yet it's much harder for an established musician to be made as well in some ways, because the music industry doesn't have the power they used to have as they do now, right? And so social media, it's just changed. Social media has so much more power. These kids operate differently. And we don't even really know how it's going to change, because they're creating and making their own roads and their own way. They're forming their own culture. And that's what's unique and interesting to watch.
Well, I have a conflict with it because I'm a songwriter myself and I'm starting to get my songs out there. And on the other hand, I like to sing alone usually. But what I can do when I sing is I just pick out any of the songs that I've known when I'm growing up, and particularly if I want, you know, some singer to, you know, if I want Bob Dylan or David Bowie, bless his soul, to listen to one of his songs, I just pull it up on YouTube and listen to it. And what I do is I go to lyrics. Now, a few years ago, when you went to lyrics, it had been sort of banned. There was, you know, a lot of the times you couldn't find any lyrics. But now you can find all the lyrics and all the songs, and you can sing together while you're reading the lyrics, right?
But
what does that do to the business? And then you know, I haven't done this for a year or two, but I'd go to iTunes, and it may have changed, but I'd go to iTunes, the top 100 list, the new songs that were on there, and I'd find the complete song on YouTube. Well, you know, on my little phone, I can just click and go to any of those songs, at least at the time, click on it, and listen to the song. I don't have to watch it. I can just listen to it for free. What does that do to the business?
Well, I think it's cannibalizing it. That's not a good aspect of it. It's cannibalizing how music and art is being propagated through society. I think that, you know, buying songs one-on-one basis through iTunes and things is huge, and that's happening. But people like to have their own music collection. And so in that way, you know, there's a whole industry there. But as far as YouTube cannibalizing, it'll be interesting to see how that develops. And it's like that with all media right now.
Well, it's the protection of copyright is really weak.
It is.
Here's another amazing thing about music and the internet. The possibility of bringing together creative artists who, under other conditions, may never would have met. Some of my other shows have related how Edgar Arendt, Patricia Welch, and I met through an English site called Academy, which was a wonderful invention by Thomas and Penny Powers. Edgar is Russian and lived in Moscow at the time, and he contacted me because of my profile, which said I wrote screenplays. It is true he thought I was a producer and wanted to work with him in films, but I wasn't at the time. Still, I listened to some of his musical scores, and I honestly believed I had discovered a Russian John Williams. Anyway, I asked him if we could work together on songs. So he told me that, coincidentally, there was another American who wanted to work with him, a singer named Patricia Welch, who just happened to live 30 miles from where I lived. All our music was created and developed over the internet and Skype, the actual mixing being largely done in Moscow, with a continual transmission of files and discussions to perfect every aspect of each song. Here's a clip from two of our songs. The first is called Love Never Withers, from an album and hopefully musical we are currently creating called Hadley's Castle.
From my eyes, I remember that day when the wind swept away life's dear comfort and warmth, and that bitter autumn day.
The second is called The Palm Springs Lullaby, which was somewhat of an exaggerated distortion and romanticization of what happened when my wife and I came here after an oil recession, finished up my B2B business in Oklahoma. Romanticized as it was an enormously fascinating and beautiful place to finally land. So here is another international internet collaboration that could never have happened 2 decades before.
Escaping from the dawn, we flee to desert skies. The final dance is on, with no more alibis, as windmills madly spin our dreams from lovesick sighs. Their dancing shadows win a gleam from downcast eyes.
That is very nice, but that kind of brightness is only one part of the picture. The disruption of the internet affects almost every area of our life and professions, some ways positive and some ways quite negative. Let's take a short break.
It is the 15th century. El Tesoro de Cielo, a Spanish treasure ship, sends a scouting expedition to a strange island. Golden statues surrounding them prove the enormity of their find. Suddenly, hordes of ghoulish creatures with scaly green flesh and skeletal wings descend upon them from the sky.
What do you think of this, Rufio?
These creatures are fragile, Captain. We could take them with our swords.
They seem supernatural. Who knows what powers they possess?
Fallen angels, weakened by their treason.
My God! Are you saying they're Nephilim, the devil's host?
I'm saying whatever they are, we can take them. Do any of you cowards dare join me?
Up against sharp knife-like nails and hideous fangs, the men's swords rip into slimy green flesh. Though black blood pours copiously from their half-naked bodies, creatures miraculously persist. Can the crew survive this bloody, cursed battle?
Find out more by Googling The Thrice Born, a new sci-fi supernatural novel by Carlos Lopez Avery and Johnny Bluestar. Google with the words Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born. That's Carlos Johnny Kendall, The Thrice Born.
Nowadays, if you are a serious business person, just getting assistance from someone with a license and a bit of experience may not be sufficient. In fact, your realtor actually needs to be knowledgeable enough to be one of your top advisors. Whether you are facilitating a giant merger or selling your company, there's a lot at stake besides your finances. There is the future value of your current investment, financial freedom, integrity, and overall reputation. If you need this kind of assistance, Sandra LaFlamme is a real estate expert with the experience, reputation, and knowledge qualified to assist you in all your key transactions. Sandra LaFlamme, real estate services with integrity and conscience. Contact her today at 888-366-8070. That's Sandra LaFlamme at 888-366-8070. New Galaxy Enterprises is a media company specializing in wide-ranging content like novels, nonfiction books, screenplays, commercial advertising, web content, etc. One of our most esteemed providers is illustrator Robert W. Zalo. I work on all my most important projects like book covers, logos, web design elements with Robert. As an illustrator, he worked on the Ignatz-nominated comic book, The Expert's Guide to Killing Things That Go Bump in the Night. His skills encompass advertising, magazine illustrations, gaming, comic books, TV production, and scenic painting. His clients include Comcast, Adelphia, Haven Talent, Forceworks, High Octane Theater, Star Creative Advertising. If you wish to contact Robert, go to johnnybluestar.com and let me know. That's johnnybluestar.com.
for artist illustrator Robert Zalo, an essential component of all the work we do. Maybe he can help you too.
We're back on Threshold after discussing the need for strong government protection from internet abuse. Need for protection of copyright ownership is one kind of protection we need. I'd like to bring up another aspect of this protection. There are certain sites which basically allow you to make comments about people or businesses. And these sites can actually, because they are third-party sites, they're publishing something, they actually can publish other people's comments without any kind of liability. Like on a local newspaper or a radio station, depending on the state, will have anti-defamation laws. You can sue somebody. But the federal government has, there are laws that protect people from being liable by these third-party publishers. And of course, to be on a radio station, even a national radio station, is not maybe sometimes as bad as being on something that can be seen by anybody throughout the world, depending on what your situation is. So we actually have something that's, again, the internet is allowing terrible damage to individuals and businesses to occur because there's no real protection for them, just like there is these copyrights and the core of people's living isn't really being protected.
Well, and I think what you're seeing, and let's look at it from a big picture, is that the internet's like the Wild West. It hasn't been around that long. You know, it might seem like it to the young people, but it really hasn't been. It's the Wild West, a whole new industry. The people who have been in power and positions to make, you know, decisions about legal rights and are in the authority positions in government didn't understand the internet. They a lot of those people still don't really understand the internet, and the younger people are coming up and they are the ones that really do have a better idea of what this internet is all about. And until we get more of those people who really understand it, start to make sense out of this, start to put laws and things in place to protect, and it's starting to happen, right? Well, let's hope it doesn't go in the wrong direction where it restricts our freedoms. But it's the Wild West, and it's just a natural evolution of society starting to put rules and regulations around a new paradigm and a new thing. And that will happen. It's just now we're in the middle of the chaos. It'll form and structure will be created.
The actual truth about this situation, which has to do with reputation management, there was a law that was really set up to protect people in third-party posters from putting out, say, pornography and getting immediately in trouble. So they gave them a certain freedom of liability. But it's the courts that allow this to go ballistic and expand to any kind of defamation. It wasn't the legislative actions, which seemed to be rather mild, but the interpretation of those laws. So the government itself participated fully consciously in allowing this type of defamation to exist without any...
There will be a pushback by the people, and then the pushback will eventually work itself out. I mean, but right now, the pain that we're suffering in a Wild West, new frontier environment is real, and it's harmful to individuals. The freedom is really great, but the pain is real. And so that whole thing, the structure and the formality is still needing to be put around it. Now, there's a huge push to not put structure around this because of the freedom that we all enjoy with it. But, you know,
we enjoy that freedom, though, Sarah, while people are watching everything that we do. So that isn't really, in other words, what you're saying, the idea that it's a wild, wild west has certainly been true. But recently, what's happened is that government really has intruded, even if there aren't laws about not saying things. If you think you're going to be surveyed and there could be very, very terrible consequences for just saying anything.
Well, the government hasn't served its role to make capitalism and protect the people. They're going in and partaking in it. They're not doing
exactly.
Their yeah. And so there's issues there. But bottom line is the internet's new. relatively speaking, I mean, this is a historical thing. I mean, the fact that we can all communicate and do all these things, the printing press took 100 years to really perforate throughout societies. The internet's only been around for maybe 2 decades. So there's a lot of work yet to do to get this thing functioning in a way that's productive for society, but yet not restrictive.
But I do think that what happened is that the government and the corporate environment has jumped on the Orwellian paradigm to use in order to shape what's happening now.
Yeah,
maybe very recently.
They joined in instead of doing what their role is. And that's not good. You know, that's why people say that you need to be, well, Thomas Jefferson always said, the nation that expects to be ignorant and free expects what never can and never will be. People need to educate themselves and understand what's going on. And then you have to fight for that. And if we don't fight for what is right, then we get what we get. And, you know, but we're in a new frontier. We really are. And things need to be worked out.
Well, we're going to return to this discussion of disruptive technology with Sarah K. Westall in just a few minutes. Kenny is a frequent guest on our show. In Kenny's novels, there is a profound exploration of the way our disruptive technology, as well as disruptive ideas about how government officials can attempt to evade our constitutional citizens' rights. In his novel, A Voluntary Spy, he explores the disruptive genetic technology of a large American corporation that conspires to create dangerous genetically modified plants, taking advantage of a grossly underregulated industry. This is just one of his many books that integrate very serious issues with exciting suspense. One of the reasons I like working with Ken Eade is that he is a fighter for liberty and an advocate for the return of our constitutional rights. As a writer myself, interested both in real social problems and writing about them, but also working in a fictional genre in novels and screenplays, I sympathize with Ken Eade's understanding that communicating with the American people cannot just be with the kind of logic, discussion, and analysis, which I believe was well deployed in this program, discussing at length the Bill of Rights. Yes, intellectual and legal outreach to American minds is important, but we must also reach out to their emotions. And I think, given both the work that he and I have done, I am totally committed to creating a kind of dual outreach in my work and to validate and promote the work that Ken Eade has done in his novels. One of these novels that directly deals with several of the Bill of Rights is A Patriot's Eye, which handles the subject of torture and deprivation of legal rights to a naturalized American citizen who is falsely accused of terrorism. In the story, Ahmed Khoury, who was born in Iraq, goes to Baghdad to help his brother and is subjected to a brutality that mirrors the actual abuse suffered by so many prisoners accused of terrorism, but who are subjected to brutal interrogation while illegally detained without adequate counsel or the possibility of a speedy or fair trial. Here is an audio excerpt from Kenny's legal thriller, A Patriot's Act. It is not a fun excerpt, but it demonstrates the power of Ken's writing, but also the reality of what we are doing to lower the bar on human rights and willing to subject our own citizens to cruelty and a lack of justice that our Constitution was formulated to prevent. In this episode, after a mock execution, Ahmed wakes up in total darkness.
Chapter 3. Ahmed opened his eyes to complete blackness.
Am I alive?
Panicking, he put his hand in front of his face and he couldn't see it. He moved his fingers. Still nothing. Ahmed's frantic eyes moved back and forth, and there was not a sliver of light.
I'm blind, he thought.
A sudden surge of adrenaline compelled him to action. His brain sent a signal to stand up, and as he did, the pain shot from his feet to his head like a hammer hit on a high striker in a carnival. Gravity pulled his broken body to his knees, and he collapsed. He felt his body. No clothing.
What happened? Am I dead?
No, he thought.
I must be alive.
He was in too much pain to be dead. He felt his chest for bullet wounds, but found none. Except for some tender spots on his chest and back and some scrapes on his knees, there was nothing.
They must have used rubber bullets.
Ahmed strained to see, but it was no use. He felt his face. It was swollen and bruised.
They must have blinded me in the shooting, he thought.
As his other four senses came to life, he realized that he was sore all over. He tried to stand again, but his legs would not cooperate. He felt them with his new eyes. The bones felt straight and unbroken.
Must be sprains, but why am I blind?
He struggled to control the panic and the terror.
Think, have to think.
Ahmed crawled on his hands and knees and propped himself up against the wall, which was as cold and damp as the floor. He felt along the walled boundaries of his confinement. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. About 7 feet in one direction. 1, 2, 3, 4. About 5 feet in the other direction. Next, he negotiated the circumference on his hands and knees. How did he get himself into this mess? From his cozy home in Santa Barbara to the battered and occupied Baghdad to this. His brother Sabine needed his help, so he went. It was as simple as that. The next events were a blur to him. The raid, his capture. Now he was in some kind of military prison. Since his capture, Ahmed had been stripped naked, cavity searched, shaved, bald, beaten, kicked, and spat on. And then the mock execution. It made his current confinement in this dark cage somewhat of a relief, not at all what it was designed for. The walls were as cold as a headstone. He felt around them until he came to a steel door. He thought of his wife, Catherine. She must know he was missing by now. But even if he was to be rescued, what good is a blind husband? An accountant by trade, there was no way he could work with figures as a blind man. He would be a complete burden on the entire family. The best thing to do is to kill myself, he thought. He had some life insurance, and wondered if it would pay off in the event of his suicide. The time passed, but Ahmed had no way of measuring it. How long have I been like this? Ahmed concentrated on his other senses, but there was no input save the sound of the pounding of his own heart. His mouth was as dry as a slab of jerky, so he tried to wet his broken lips with his tongue. In despair, he dropped to the floor. Lying there on his back, he rubbed his eyes, and suddenly, he saw tiny stars above him in the blackness. Light! I can see light! The tiny stars spread out in a geometric pattern like symbols in a matrix. This can't be stars. They're not random. Ahmed's accountant's brain analyzed the patterns of light, but then they turned into eyes, angrily staring at him. Stop! Stop! Please! Somebody help me! Then the eyes pulled back to reveal a miniature firing squad with their rifles trained on Ahmed. He heard the blast of the rifles, almost in slow motion, and felt the bullets ripping through his flesh as his brain switched off.
We're back on Threshold Radio with Sarah K. Westall, and we're discussing disruptive technology. And let's return for a moment to the to printing in general and what has happened throughout the centuries to this technology and its effect on people and actually on freedom.
Well, I think it's a really interesting thing to look at, the, you know, how that all came to be with the printing press and how, you know, history and relate it to what's going on today. And, you know, when the printing press, before the printing press happened, monks would do all the writing and they were the educated people in society. And there was, you know, the very wealthy were educated, but the regular people were not. They didn't know how to read. They didn't know how to write. And when the printing press came out, that's when the masses suddenly had a means of being able to learn how to read and write. And the printing press, it was a one-to-many technology. And it was an amazing advancement for society because now the masses could learn. And that's when schools started being set up. And that's when society fundamentally changed. But, you know, that's when we started getting pushback from a lot of institutions. I know the Catholic Church was pushing back because what happened was there were factions that were starting to compete with, you know, the Catholic Church or with governments, you know, institutions, monarchies and dictators were in place, mostly monarchies at the time, and they were trying to fight for freedom as well. And so the interesting thing is when you look at the countries that restricted the freedom of the printing press compared to the countries that didn't, they are still feeling the economic impacts of that. The countries that allowed the printing press to be free and people to be freely able to learn, you know, it really is credited for bringing on the Renaissance, the explosion of learning and art and science. And the countries that did not allow that to flourish fell behind economically. And to this day, they were still economically behind the ones that allowed the printing press to flourish.
That's really amazing.
Yeah, and the thing that we should learn from that is if we look at the internet today, you see a lot of that same patterns occurring where people are worried about, you know, we have real issues as far as, you know, reputation, people tearing down people's reputation and all the bad things that we're seeing occurring on the internet. However, there's this swelling of people fearful of what the internet is doing, whether it's business people, you know, the business agendas wanting to maintain their power and control over an industry, or whether it's governments wanting to maintain power and control over geopolitics or whatever they're trying to get accomplished. But the countries and the areas that restrict freedom of information, it's not necessarily freedom to do bad things. It's not freedom to break the laws. That's different. Freedom to break the laws, you want to cut that down. But freedom to pass information that's truth, that's that's reality. Freedom to pass truth and learning and flourishing and science and advancement in society. You got to look at what happened to the countries back when the printing press, the countries that, you know, that restricted that freedom and that growth fell economically. And that is the same thing that's going to happen today with the countries that limit that growth, because what you're ultimately limiting is freedom of innovation and growth and thriving as a society. And so it's important for us to, you know, take that big picture and learn from history, which would be an amazing thing, huh? Learning from history.
It would be. It doesn't seem like we've learned too much insofar as we now have, disruptive nuclear technology that stands poised at any moment to do something much more dangerous than anything that's ever happened before, except for maybe climate change. So
yeah, the nuclear stuff is pretty scary. That's a whole nother topic.
Yes, we will go to keep that from happening, from getting into too painful a discussion. Since
yeah, let's
so far,
be positive sometimes.
Yeah, so because this, we're going to go in a little bit direction, and we're going to discuss your main interest here. Let's go back to this article by Cuddy, where he points out the analysis of the disruptive process developed by Stephen Sinofsky, who he says is a former Microsoft president, and Andreessen Horowitz, who Cuddy points out is a board partner investor. These are guys who worked on a theory. He says, while Sinofsky writes primarily about the disruptive effects of technology on established industries and incumbents, I think the framework he proposes is instructive for book publishing. So here's Cuddy's take on the four stages of disruption described by Sinofsky. So the first part, it's where the product is, the innovative product is introduced. Sinofsky calls this disruption stage. In music, focusing on consumer listening to songs being played, I'd say this is digital downloads and streaming beginning to replace vinyl, CDs, and other hard, you know, things like cassettes, and to grab market share. The second stage is called evolution, and that's where innovation spreads to the industry. At this point, evolution begins to grow, and I'd say now we're talking about various accessory products to the computer, including internet programs like Pandora and iTunes and YouTube, and technology like cell phones, tablets, and even satellite radio starting to consume the music space. So now everything is moving into the internet. And it's spreading very quickly. The third stage is convergence, where the old sector and the industry and the spanky new invader begin to work together. This happens. This happened. Like you said before, vinyl is basically a small niche now, though it exists. And there are still CDs around. But in the fourth stage, which may have started already, it's called reimagination, where the imprint and evolution of the new invader takes over, like the car did for the horse and buggy, although I believe you can still take some kind of ride around Central Park. You're certainly not riding around in those things, although sometimes I'd really appreciate it if we could. What do you think of this particular delineation of the disruptive process, you know, where we're talking about disruption, evolution, convergence, and reimagination? What is your big picture like of the disruption process?
Well, I think it's, you know, fairly accurate. I mean, disruption is something that comes in and takes market share from somebody else from a business perspective, you know, but disruption from a society perspective, disruption can be a negative word. And I don't necessarily look at it as negative in the sense of how, you know, because not everything is, most innovations where we're making advancements isn't a negative thing. If it's, depending on your perspective, it's disruption to the company that has power that's losing market share. And so in that sense, it's disruptive to the status quo, but it could be a very beneficial thing for society. Now, does it, it starts off, it gets introduced, people realize what it is, and then, you know, there's usually a fight back. They try to do whatever they can to keep that technology from losing, you know, from losing their market share. And then it eventually goes side by side and then it eventually takes over. And the reason it takes longer to take over is because there's that pushback by the powers that be. The interesting the development that you'll see now with businesses is they know that's the process and they don't want to be the business that loses out and loses market share and is the victim of disruption. And so what's now going on is there's a process of venture capital and investing that's going on with the powers that be. So the people who are and the companies that are in power now know that the innovation happens at the smaller companies. And so what they're doing is they're funding a lot of that innovation through venture capitalists. They're owning these small companies and then they're buying them out. So they're owning a specific, you know, a decent percentage. Once they get to a certain size, they buy them out. So they're buying out this innovation to make sure they're not victims of this disruption. And so there's good and bad to that. In theory, if they're the ones supporting the disruption and supporting innovation, we could really flourish. But the problem is if their current industry is a cash cow and it's really, really making them money, and the disruption that's coming or the new innovation that's coming won't be as profitable, then they're going to buy it out and then shut it down.
Oops, I think you're talking about the oil business.
Well, I'm talking about every industry, but yes, okay. The oil business is like that.
It's kind of a major problem that type of technology is being suppressed.
Well, but it's being systematized, right? It's the process is being, because they figured it out a lot. The business world has figured it out. There's been so many disruptions where there's been a lot of victims and, you know, a lot of giants have gone under. And so instead of just being blind and putting our blinders on, let's partake in it. Let's shut them down. Let's either buy them out and be on the front of this and let's lead this innovation because we can make more money this way, or at least we can make the same amount. But if it's going to hurt our cash cow and we're going to make less, then let's not let this go forward. Well, and so that's the trends going on right there with disruption.
Well, We're approaching the end of our program. This is there's going to be another break in a moment, but let me just mention something about the Cuddy's discussion of the publishing business. I would say that what he's talking about is really starts with Amazon, which when it was released and being introduced to the marketplace in 2007 to 2009. Well, then, what happens next is Kindle, the product of Amazon, begins to become a massive element along with other ebooks from 2010 to 2013. Now, in phase three, this convergence phase, there you can still get, I get a lot of books from Amazon, hardcover books. I go to the library. I'm still reading books. They're still around. There are still bookstores, but there are less bookstores, right, Sarah?
Less bookstores, people tend to go with ebooks more and more.
But even so, there is still a sort of a brisk business.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So just before we go to our break, just give me an idea what you might foresee for the next level when the convergence level is over with and we start to get into reimagination and the whole industry is totally goes online.
Well, you know, it really comes to what the young people do, because we grew up with books. So our paradigm of books, you know, ebooks or books, we just like books still. But, you know, I teach at the University of Minnesota. I teach an entrepreneur class, and I've taught for a couple of years now. And each time I like to have my book online because it's easier to work with. And a lot of the students, you know, use it online. Some buy books and other ones just go completely online. And I think it all comes down to what the young people are going to do. And I keep saying that because they've grown up differently than we have. You know, you look at students, they still have books, but so much of their stuff is happening online. And so it just like, and I keep saying the printing press took 100 years to really, infiltrate into societies. I don't know if it, I think it could really be 100 years because the people, you know, for something like ebooks and things to be online to completely take over. Now, when you look at the news online is completely taking over because we don't have time. I just want to read something quick online. I don't want to bother with the newspaper because the newspaper was always a quick read. It was always getting the headlines, quickly understanding what's going on and moving on. A book is a different paradigm. It's a, I'm picking something up and I'm reading something in depth and I'm really diving into this book, right?
Yeah.
So it's a different behavior and it's a different engagement with the media. And so it'll all come down to what these young people do as a way of life and how they like to function. Because us older people, I don't think we're ever going to completely change to ebooks as a mass, you know, as everyone, for example, because there's too much of us that have grown up with books and still enjoy that process. Now it all comes down to the young people. Are they going to completely change over and say, I don't need that anymore? And that's the big question. And I think it'll be based on their behavior.
Sarah, we're going to go to break now and we'll be back in a moment.
This is Johnny Bluestar. I've worked as a lyricist with Patricia Welch for over 5 years, along with Russian composer Edgar Ahrens, a friend and colleague. Her ability as a singer is simply amazing. She brings a unique and dramatic flair to every song she sings. Over the next few months, we shall be releasing a number of these songs, part of an album called Hadley's Castle. Meanwhile, Patricia has been busy creating a super enjoyable collection of classic standards in an exciting 46-song, 3-CD collection.
Music for Great Entertaining introduces Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia Welch. 3 hours of continuous music. 46 of the all-time classic standards, spanning decades of hit songs. Going to a friend's home for dinner? Cocktails, Dinner, and Dessert with Patricia also makes the perfect hostess gift. This 3-CD compilation is the perfect background music that sets just the right mood for any dinner party.
I'm crazy for feeling so lonely. There was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy.
To purchase this album, just go to patriciawelch.com/CD. That is patriciawelch.com/CD. You won't be disappointed.
The following is from West Side Warrior, the memoir of Ray Boylan, a Korean War veteran and crime fighter. He was there fighting in the world's coldest battlefield when the Chinese communists invaded.
Desperate squad members ran past our foxhole yelling, "Get the hell out of here! There's too many of them!" Again, we saw the Chinese soldiers charging in with opium-induced mindlessness, oblivious of our bullets. Again, we heard the bugles and whistles. Climbing out of our foxhole, Bob dropped 2 hand grenades behind us, and I threw one over my shoulder. Bullets whizzing by our heads, Bob and I became bolts of lightning flashing across the mountainside. Like a hideous film, desperate scenes like this played out on the Tokong Pass for 3 days. Sometimes I played in the scene. Sometimes I could only watch and wonder if it were real, or if I'd be suddenly jolted out of my trance by an RKO usher saying, "Hey, did you kids sneak in here?"
To acquire this book, Google westsidewarrior.boylan.kindle. Boylan is spelled B-O-Y-L-A-N. That's West Side Warrior, Boylan, Kindle.
We're back on Threshold Radio. This is the, unfortunately, the end of this wonderful program with Sarah K. Westall discussing disruptive technology and its effect on the world and our country. Sarah, could you tell us something about how to contact you and the various things that you offer the public and possibly even advertisers?
Oh, absolutely. You can go to my website at sarahwestall.com, S-A-R-A-H, westall.com, and you can find all my past shows. And I cover all sorts of things, you know, from energy and economics and medicine. There's just so many things that where there's innovation and exciting things going on. And I, of course, I'm always looking for sponsors. So my radio show is within the next month or two, we're going to be going nationwide. Right now we air in New York, Rhode Island, and Connecticut, and we're on over 90 channels in podcasts, but we're going to be airing nationwide and actually in 120 countries. So it's going pretty broad. Yeah, it's pretty broad. And so we are looking for sponsors all the time. And it's a very unique show where I have just top guests all the time, really diving into these topics. And once again, I take a business perspective. I try to stay positive. You know, this, we got a little negative on some things, but you know, reality sometimes is the truth can be negative at times. And we try to take a positive spin on things, but it's not always positive, but it's a business perspective. And I think there's a lot we can learn by talking to the top experts all over the world.
Me too. And I encourage everyone to visit Sarah's website and listen to a program. I did, and I enjoyed very much. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I had so much fun, and there's so much more I could talk about.
Well, we will. We're going to ask you to come back. Thank
you
so much.
Okay, I appreciate it.
Take care. My company, New Galaxy Enterprises, is a California corporation specializing in the creation of media and promotional content. We are focused on original, innovative projects that are good for humanity. These projects could be nonfiction books or novels, fictional screenplays or documentary content, websites and website content, commercial advertising content for print, audio, or video products on the internet, television, or radio, musical scores for advertising, television, or film, video, audio editing, etc. We want to promote products and projects that support the environment, encourage a healthy experience in living, developing, nurturing, and useful technology, and offering platforms for positive, socially constructive entertainment or informative, transformative media. Our experience in creating a variety of products like this is rather vast, and we offer client-based and collaborative products, as well as the opportunity of active investors to join us in the creation and promotion of proprietary products, some of which are in latter stages of development. For more information, go to www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. That's www.newgalaxyenterprises.com. If you're interested in talking to us, just fill out the contact sheet and we will get back with you. Patty Greer is a singer, songwriter, and musician whose life took a strange change in direction, leading her to become an expert in the arcane subject of crop circles. This transformation of her life gave her a sense of direction and purpose that turned her into an award-winning filmmaker and relentless explorer of dozens of crop circles. Her songs on YouTube and her films that can be bought or sampled on pattygreer.net are a must for anyone challenged by the strange phenomena of crop circles that have appeared throughout the world, particularly in England. Her films are wonderful, but her songs and music give us a sense of why this caring person was chosen to be one of the most important advocates to remind us of this incredible phenomena right in our midst. We go out with Patty Greer's We Want Our Planet Back.
Charge here.
Who's in charge here?
let's do it differently. It's sickening all the people, and it's killing all the trees. It's falling in our eyes, and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the freedom to be free. Landing in the water, we know it's in the air. It's time for you and me to show we care. Say no to GMOs hiding in our food, and no to fluoride in our water too. Who's in charge here? Let's save this family and do what's right for Earth and you and me. Step into the new way,
into the new way,
where we live in harmony. No more war, no more fracking. We are free. Let's do it differently. Sickening all the people, and it's killing all the trees. It's falling in our eyes, and it's getting harder to see the beauty that is our world and the
freedom
to be free.
We are free.